So welcome everyone to the review session for Quiz Zero. Just as a reminder, it's going to be happening next Wednesday at 1 o'clock. It's a good idea to check the course website for the location. So everything that you need to know is on this sheet. There are three locations, so look where you're supposed to be according to your last name. Apart from that, also on the website, there is a review sheet, the ones that we handed out just now. They're all available under quizzes. And also last year, quiz zero and quiz one, which are the quizzes that you need to know for quiz zero this year. It's a good idea to look at the questions and answers. And later on this week, the sections will be focusing on quiz zero, and it's going to be a review section. So that's all the details you need to know. We're going to have five TFs today presenting this review session. So those are the topics that we're going to go over today. I would like just to, by show of hands, if you want any particular topic for us, to go in depth into, or, just give it more time. Otherwise, we're just going to assume that you want us to cover everything. So do you have, if you skim through them, do you have any preferences?
So
during
as students.
Okay, of course. So any time you want to stop a TF, just raise your hand while we're explaining. Don't wait until the end, and you can ask any question on the spot. So we don't have any specific ones that you want us to go over. Okay. So we're just gonna start. I'll be presenting the first five topics, I believe. So first of all, binary numbers, they might look scary because we're not used to them, but they're basically any numeral system. You need to know the following about it. Any number in any numeral system, so if we've got a system that runs on base B, so the one that we usually use is the base 10 system. So if we've got a base B system, basically every digit or place is going to be representing B to the 0. And then when you move to the left, it's going to be B to the 1, B to the 2, and so on for every place. What does that mean? So for example, let's say we have the system, the binary system, and we've got a number that's 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. And we will ask you to convert this number from binary into decimal. What you would do, it's quite straightforward, go here and say this represents 0 times 2 to the 0. The following one, what would it represent, the second place? 1 times 2 to the 1. And this will be 1 times 2 to the 2, and so on and so forth until we get to this will be 1 times 2 to the 6, correct. So what do we do with these digits in order to produce the decimal representation of this number? Just add them, correct. Okay, so 1 times 2 to the 6, that would be 64. And this is a 0, so we ignore it. This is 1 times 2 to the 4, so that will be 2 to the 4, 16, plus 4, plus 2. And that will give us 86. This 86 is in decimal representation. So that's how we basically convert from binary to decimal. Now, similarly, although it might be complicated with different numbers, if we tell you to take the decimal number 255. This should be an easy number to convert into binary because it's a special number. What's special about this number? For an 8-bit binary number. Sorry? Right, so when we say it's an 8-bit binary number, that means that it's a number that's represented by 8 bits. 36. So the biggest number that we can represent with an 8-bit number is when we have all the digits set to 1, right? That will be the biggest number. And this number will equal to, so if we say like this is 1 times 2 to the 7 until we get 1 times 2 to the 0, and we add these, this is going to give us what number in decimal? So 1 times 2 to the 7 plus 2 to the 6, 2 to the 5, and so on and so forth until 2 to the 0. 255, okay? So if we ask you to convert from decimal to binary, that will be the answer, okay? But of course, for like 254, what would 254 be? Change the last one to 0. Why? Because this will make this 0 times 2 to the 0, so it's going to subtract 1 from the 255. Okay? Any questions so far? Very neat. Okay. So what do we have here? So apart from converting from one numeral system to another, we're going to be adding... We might ask you to add numbers in binary. So we've got this number, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, that we want to add to 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. So how would you approach addition in binary? Correct. So I'll explain. So what she said was, just like we do addition in decimal, and we do the carry bit every time we exceed the number 9, will be the carry bit every time we exceed the number 1. Okay. So an easy way to do it is just to put it to align the two numbers together and add it. Right. So the 0 plus 0 would be similar to what we do in decimal, it'll be a 0. And there is no carry bit. Okay? Make sure in the quiz to put your carry bits clear at the top, if you have any. So 0 plus 1, that will be 1. Now 1 plus 1 in decimal, we would say it's 2. But because we're dealing with binary, 1 plus 1 would mean 0, but with a carry bit of 1. Okay, so. And then what would this give us, the next digit? So a 0 and a 1, a 0 and a 1, and then a 0 and a 1, a 1 and a 1. Is this clear? And of course, like as an exercise, if you want to convert this into decimal and add it, you'll get the same as the result, as this result in decimal. Okay? Sweet. So variable types, all you need to know about that is that in order for the compiler to know how much to allocate for each of your variables that you declare or define in your program, you need to give it a type. And each variable type has a different size, right? So those are the variable types that we used most in the problem sets. And there are many others if you want to look them up online. But so basically a char... takes up 1 byte. How much is that in bits? 8 bits. So 8 bits is equivalent to 1 byte. An integer or an int has size 4 bytes, which is 32 bits. And then long is double the size of an integer. So it's 8 bytes. And then be careful whenever we ask for the size of char star. Char star is basically a pointer to a char. Int star is a pointer to an int. Later in the review session, we're going to explain pointers. We're going to go over them again or review them. But basically, why are all three of them down there with size 4 bytes? Why is that? 32-bit address. Right, so it's a 32-bit address. So you have to know that everything, when we say whatever pointer, it will have the size 32 bits or 4 bytes. because it's going to be an address to a certain location, and this address is going to be represented by a number. And this number is always 32 bits or 4 bytes for our purposes, okay? Do you have any questions about variable types and sizes? Yeah, sure.
What's a double? Like, how is a double different from a long one?
So a double has more precision, is that correct? Okay, so thing is, it differs from one system to another. So what is it in C? I just want to ask the other TF, so one second. For the double, the size?
We'll look it up.
We'll look it up in a second and we'll let you know. It's just because it differs from one system to another. So I'll just make sure what size you need to know for a double. So floats and double have more precision in decimal points. Okay, so that's how it's different from integers and long-long. Integers and long-long, they don't have any decimal points after the decimal point. So it's just more precision with it. I'll look up the size in a second. Any other questions? Okay. So ASCII characters, what do you need to know about that? Who can tell me what ASCII code is? Why do we use the ASCII code? Kind of thing.
ASCII code refers to the alphabet, integers, and
so you said to represent alphabetical characters and like punctuation and symbols, right? How do we represent instead of to represent these numbers, we actually refer to them with an 8-bit number. This 8-bit number is an integer. So each character or symbol has a corresponding 8-bit integer to it. So for example, when we say what is capital A in ASCII code, like how can we represent character A in numbers? The capital A is? Sorry, say again?
Is it 122?
For capital A, you're sure? Sorry, yeah. So it's the capital A is 65. And basically, in order to know all the representations for the alphabetical characters, I'm just talking about the alphabetical characters and not all the symbols, you would need to know only the capital A representation, which is 65, because the small letter A is 32 away from 65. So that will have an ASCII representation of 97. So from there, you can almost deduce any other alphabetical character ASCII representation. So like small a would be 98, right? Sorry? Small b, yeah. Did I say a? Okay. Yeah. Small b would be 98. And it's going to be always separated by 32 from the small case to the uppercase. Okay? Neat. Switch statements. I assume that everybody has like a solid understanding of if statements, if else statements, nested if statements. You have seen them a lot in the problem sets and in your code, so probably a good idea is just like to go through your problem set. One of the conditional setups that we didn't use much was switch statements. What switch statements do is just like give you a neater way to represent conditional statements. So you say switch variable, so you're testing the value of what's inside the argument for switch, which is variable, and then you say, okay, case when variable is a certain value. So when you say, for example, let's say switch A, and A is a variable, and you say when case 1, that means when A is 1. And then, for example, case 10 would be when A is 10. And then the rest is pretty straightforward. You say case 1, then do this, and then break. Break means, okay, once you're done with this statement, then move on to the rest of the code after the switch. we also recommend having a default case that's like saying if this, else if, else. So the last else statement, yeah.
What would you expect in the shorthand version if else, like question mark operators?
Right, yeah, so this is like not necessarily strict, it's not strictly in the quiz. Just 1 second. We'll go over it in the section that follows, okay? I'll go over it in a second. Any other questions? Okay. So just to go over the ternary operator that you were asking about, so one of the shorthands for conditional statements. One of the shorthands for the conditional statements is the ternary operator. Basically, the syntax goes as follows. So this is the condition, and we put a question mark after it, and that means if this is true, then do the condition do this if true. So basically, this is a prototype, so what I'm writing here, you're going to basically fill it out with a C statement, and then do this if false. So is this clear? There's a question mark and a colon here.
What is it in the middle?
A colon here? Yeah. Okay? Pretty clear? Any other questions? Okay. Jesse?
Okay. I'm Jesse. We'll be going through functions, variable scope, dynamic memory allocation, and buffer overflows. There was a question before about doubles and floats and the size of those. And so the answer to that question is that the standard for C doesn't specify like it does for ints and long longs, where it says that int must be, you know, at least 32 bits, long long must be at least 64 bits. There's no specification for that. The general standard, though, is that a float is 32 bits, so 4 bytes, and a double is twice the size, so 8 bytes, 64 bits. So if that clarifies that. All right, so let's go through functions. Functions are a great way to package code that you're going to use multiple times in your program. Have something, like the first place where we really saw functions come into use heavily was in problem set 3 and also in problem set 4, where you have all these functions, draw board, do move, things like this, that these things are going to happen multiple times throughout your code. And so if you have, like, to draw the board took maybe 10, 20 lines of code, you don't want to write that every place in your code where you would want to draw the board. So instead, you can package all of this code into a function, and now whenever you need to draw the board, now you just have a single line of code. So one thing, this saves you time. Second thing, it improves readability, right? If somebody is looking over your code, they don't every time have to see this large construct of loops and variables and things like this. They just see one line, draw board, and maybe they don't even have to read the function and see what it does. They just can tell from the name. And so what do functions do? Well, functions have arguments, and they have a return value. And functions can have zero or more arguments, and they can return something or they can return nothing. And so how do you declare a function? Well, you would have here, just like main. Main is the first function in your program. Main is a function just like any other function. It so happens that main is where your program starts running. So we would have here, for declaration of a function, return type. Then we have the name of the function. Then, in parentheses, we have a list of arguments. And then in here, we have our code for the function. And so I'm sure you've all had experience declaring functions before and you've seen it in your code, but the important thing is every function has to have a name, otherwise how are you going to call it? Function, you put your arguments in here in a list, parameterized list, and so maybe we'd have, you know, one argument be int a, and then we'd have another one int b. So maybe this is a function that takes two arguments, and we want it to return, well, we can have it return another integer, and let's say this function will be the average of two integers. For a very simple example, and then in here, what would we write? Well, I'll just do it. We would have return a plus b divided by 2. And so this is a very simple example, but you know, your functions can be as big or as small as you like. And so this, all this is saying is we have a function called average. It takes in two integers as arguments, and it returns an integer. For somebody using this function, they don't have to know how it works, right? All they have to know is that it takes two integers, returns an integer. That's the beauty of functions. It hides the internal implementation of code from somebody else using it. You all use functions. You use printf. You may have used scanf. You definitely all use getint, getString. Aaron?
So will that always return the correct average?
Well, in this case, it will. Oh, the question was, will this always return the correct average? Well, one would hope so. The implementation of functions is up to the person who implements them, right? If you're using this function average, you don't know how it's implemented per se. You just know that this is what it does. So one would hope that it's implemented correctly. It's up to you when you're writing functions to implement them correctly. That's the answer to that question. Any other questions about functions? All right, so let's go on to scoping. So when you have variables that are declared locally, which, for example, if I'm writing in main, you know, int A, int B, int C, those variables only exist within the nearest set of brackets in which they're declared. So most of you declare variables at the top of your functions. You can only use those variables in the function in which they're declared. That's why in problem set 3, when we had the game of 15, we had board represented as a global variable. Why? Because we were doing a lot of work with different functions, and all of those functions needed to access these variables and make changes to them. And so, for example, let's say I have this function average, and then in main, I'm using average. So I have here int A, well, let's just give them different names, int X, int Y. And then I do average X, Y, right? What happens is copies of X and Y are given to the function average. And then X and Y become the variables int A and int, become the variables A and B in average. And as soon as average finishes, these variables here are gone, right? The only thing that main has back is the return value of average. So we might want to assign this int z here. So the variables that average uses in the function are gone. And the best example that you've seen of this is swap, where if we write a swap function, we swap two integers a and b. When the function leaves, the variables are gone because the variables only exist within the scope of these two brackets here, the nearest brackets in which they are declared. If some of you were writing a program, wrote a for loop, and declared some variables in your for loop, and then tried to use it outside of your for loop, you may have seen a compiler error of some sort. That's because the variables that you're declaring in your for loop only exist within the brackets of your for loop. As soon as you get out of those brackets, those variables cease to exist. Questions about scope? Yes? No, functions can only return a single value at once. And so if you've seen examples of passing arguments by reference, where in lecture we wrote an improved version of swap, where you're passing pointers instead of passing variables. So then swap can modify what's stored at the location in those pointers, and that's a way to get around having a single return value, because you can pass as many arguments in as you want that swap can then modify. But return value is only one, or zero. You can have void, which means that nothing is returned. All right, so dynamic memory allocation. So how do we get around this problem of scoping, problem of, well, let's say we have a program and we don't know how much memory we're going to need right up front at the beginning of the program. You know, let's say we're asking, getting strings, for example. We don't know how long the string that the user is going to type in is going to be. We don't know, maybe the user is going to want to type in multiple strings. So we can't declare, you know, arrays of chars for these strings at the start of our program, because there's no way to predict how long they'll be. So what do we use? We use dynamic memory allocation. Malloc is a function for that. And this allows you to get memory in your program while it's running. And so the format of that is malloc is a function that takes a single argument, an integer, and it returns a pointer to a location. The integer is the size of the memory you want to get. So let's write this size here for clarification. And so what malloc does is it goes into the computer, it gets you some memory for your variable, and then it returns you a pointer to that memory. And so this memory is persistent. It's not local memory like we saw when we declare variables inside of functions or inside of brackets. It doesn't go away. It stays until you explicitly tell it to go away. And you tell it to go away by using the function free. And you put in a pointer. And that says free the memory at this location. And so you call malloc, you would say, get me something that can store 10 chars. So you would write 10 times size of char. And you would put that in here. And so malloc is going to go, it's going to return you a pointer to that location. And then you can treat that in your program as an array of chars with length 10. And then when you're done using this array of chars, and this array of chars is pretty much like a global variable. You can refer to it anywhere. Any function will have access to it. When functions leave, this will still continue to exist until your program ends or until you call free. And when you call free, then this memory goes away. So this gives you more control over your memory, over the scope of your memory, essentially. So what are the dangers when we have malloc? Well, null pointers are one of the dangers, right? When we start working with pointers, you start getting null pointers. Malloc returns null if it's unable to get the memory. And so whenever you call malloc, you should always check to make sure it didn't return a null pointer. That's one thing. But we'll talk about pointers more, one of the later presenters. So the last thing is buffer overflow errors. And this is something that happens a lot when you're dealing with user input. So let's say I'm asking the user for a string in a program. And then I have some char array to store their string. And I say, well, the user's probably not going to type more than 100 characters. So I'll just declare this array, char. Input 100. And then I use some function that's going to get input from the user and put it in this array. And so it happens that some of these functions, like scanf and things like this, are what's called unsafe. Meaning, what's going to happen is if the user types in more than 100 characters, and I'm not doing any check to make sure that I'm only letting them type in 100 characters or something like that, scanf, which is basically what getString uses in some ways, well, it's not, but similar, is just going to start filling up this array from the beginning, and it's just going to keep going past the end. Because as we saw, we don't really know where an array ends. The only way to know where an array ends is to keep explicit track of how long it is. That's why you have to loop over arrays with the length of an array. You saw this when you did binary search. You always had to pass in the array and the length of the array. And so the array is just going to get filled up. And if the string is longer, it's going to keep going past the end. And so maybe here's our array in memory. And then here are some other important variables. And so when scanf goes, it's going to start here. And the string is too long. It's going to overwrite all of these important variables. And we've just had a buffer overflow. We may have lost important data. Our program may crash. Hackers may use this to, cause all sorts of errors. And there are very cool courses you can take where you learn to do this. CS61, by the way. And so that's what a buffer overflow is. And the way to avoid this is to use explicit bounds checking and be very careful when you're dealing with strings. And so for an example of this, I would point you to getString. GetString is an example of a safe function. You'll see how it avoids buffer overflows. You can look at the code for that on the site. All right, thanks very much. If there are any questions, I'll take Questions? No. Okay. Here is Batul then.
Okay. So, can you guys hear me? So I'll be talking about arrays and what arrays are. So the important thing to understand about arrays is that they are a set of elements of the same type stored contiguously in memory. And all of that, that this entire statement is really, really important because you need to know that an array, for example, can be an array of ints, it can be an array of chars, it can be an array of strings, but the important thing, it can be an array of arrays, in fact, but they all have to be of the same type. And so the useful thing with that is because you know that they're of the same type, you can use pointer arithmetic to randomly access any element in that array. And that will allow you to, that will give you a lot of power because you don't have to loop through the entire array to get to the seventh element, for example. So how does one declare an array? You would say, if I wanted an array of chars, you could say char my array. And then you would give it a size, say 10 over here, and then you have an array of chars. Now the important thing to remember is that my array itself, without the bracket notation after this, is a pointer to a char. So you can also say char star my array. Now the randomly accessing part of this is that you can access the seventh element of my array using this notation. How would I do so? If I wanted the seventh element of the seventh char in my array, how would I access it? Right. My array 6. And why is it my array 6 and not my array 7? I'm sorry? Right. So arrays are zero indexed. And this is important because if you're trying to access the seventh element and you're writing in your program or my array 7, you're actually going to get the eighth element. So now that you know this about arrays, you also should know that how to go between the two syntax of the brackets and the pointers that we talked about earlier. So if I wanted to access the sixth, seventh element of my array using the syntax, I would say my array 6. However, if I didn't want to use the syntax, how could I write? How could I access that same element? Anyone? Yeah.
Can you type array, my array plus 6?
Okay. I can write my array plus 6. What does this do? Okay. What is my array? Right. It's a pointer to the first element, but what is the type of the first element? I declared it to be a char. I erased it. Sorry. But it's a pointer to the first element, which is a char. And so my array is of type char star. What is my array plus 6 then? If I'm adding something to a pointer, I'm moving that pointer along by 6 slots. So what is my array plus 6? Right, right. So the answer that he gave was that this entire thing is the address of the sixth element in the array. So if we actually want to access that element, how would we do so? Right. And what is that star called? The dereferencing operator. And so this is equivalent to saying my array 6. Now, if you noticed, I used that this is a char star, which means that this is an array of chars. What do we know is also called, is another name for referring to an array of chars? A string, right? So a string is an array of chars. The important thing about a string is that it's null terminated, so that at the end of all of the chars that you have this special char, and it's the null terminator, and it's, I think it's this. So if I had this string, What is the size of the array hello? Anyone? Sorry? 14. However, if I count these, how many letters are here? How many characters are in this string? 13. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. However, as someone mentioned, the size of the array hello is 14 because you have the null terminator at the end. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah.
When you have a two-dimensional array, how does that play out in terms of where stuff is in memory?
Okay, one second, I'll do that. Okay, when you have a two-dimensional array, you basically have an array of pointers to arrays. So a two-dimensional array. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, because we were talking about contiguous locations in memory, the question was, when you have a two-dimensional array, how does that play out in terms of accessing the memory? And so the answer is that an array, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, so the array board I, so board I, or I guess we'll use D, because this is the same thing as an array of pointers to arrays. Does that make sense? So the way that two-dimensional arrays are stored is that you actually have, if you have an array of ints, you have one int here, one int here, one int here, one int here, and you have an array of ints, and it's pretty straightforward. However, if instead you want a two-dimensional array, that means you will have a pointer to some other array here, and that would be the first row. This is your second row, and these are basically pointers to other arrays. And that's how a two-dimensional array works. But awesomely enough, you don't have to worry about this because arrays give you this syntax in order to access it. Is that pretty much clear? Okay. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was segmentation faults. And segmentation faults occur in many places, but one place where they often occur is when you try to access parts of an array that aren't yours. So if you had an array of size D over here, but instead of putting D, I tried to access D plus 10. This could cause a segmentation fault because the array does not extend to D plus 10 characters there, and so you're trying to access a value that's not there. Another one is if you're trying to access board negative 1. By the syntax rules that we discussed earlier, it goes to the place where board points, and it moves back one point. However, that it may not necessarily be part of your array, and if it's not part of your array, you're going to cause a segmentation fault because you're trying to access memory that isn't yours. The next thing is I wanted to talk about is argc and argv. So when you call main, with int main int argc int argv. So these two arguments to main are given to you by the shell where you call the command. When you call the command, say vgenerate keyword, that the shell gives you main, and in main it gives you the number of arguments that were called when your program was called, and it gives you the arguments. So, I'm sorry, yes?
So I think the second one is char star, right? It's an array of
strings. Oh, right, sorry. Typo? Okay, yes, it is a char star. So main is going to give you argc. Now, argc includes the name of your program. So, of course, argc is going to be at least one. However, if you give it more arguments, argc will be greater than one, and you can check for how many arguments are given by checking whether argc, if you wanted only one argument, what would you check for argc to be equal to? One or two? Two. Why two? Right, exactly. So if you wanted two arguments, you would check for argc to be three, and so on and so forth. And in argv is stored all the arguments after the name of your program. So argv is an array of strings. So in each element of argv, there is a char star, which is a string, and it stores the strings that you pass in as arguments to your program. So if I called this to my program, what is argc? And I pressed enter after this. What is argc? Yeah. I'm sorry? It's three, right. The answer is three. And it's because this is the first argument, this is the second argument, and this is the third argument. What is argv? I'm sorry, yes?
So a string and a pointer are the same thing, right?
No, not exactly, but sort of.
So you can't say that argv is an array of pointers.
Argv is an array of pointers. Yes. And so argv0 is the string noob. And argv, what is argv1?
It
cuts off the first one. No? Okay, sorry. Which is the name of your program. Okay, right, sorry. So argv1 is the string noob, and argv2 is what? Okay, it's 42, but is it, what is it? It's a string 42. It's not an int 42. Okay, and really quickly, I wanna bring up this line of code, or this part of code. And if you could just sort of look at it for a couple minutes and see where could this cause a segmentation fault. Can someone just sort of think out loud about what could be the problem with this? In light of what I talked earlier about possible problems with arrays? Well, let's see what parts of the array values are we accessing. So in the first iteration of what is the first value that count gets to? Yeah, one. So you have values one, and then what's the second one? Two, and then? So it's going to go inside the first inner loop four times. Do you see that? Yeah. And so it's going to go through the inner loop four times. So it's going to increment count four times. And so count is going to be five. And then I will be one. And then it's going to go through the inner loop again. Once it goes through the inner loop again, count will be what? Five. And then it's going to be six. Then it's going to be seven. And then it's going to be 8. However, you don't own values 8. Values 8 is beyond the bounds of your array, so if it belongs to some other program or some other process in your memory, it could possibly cause a segmentation fault because you're accessing parts of your array that are not actually yours. Yes?
So to fix it, what you should do is make count equal to 0.
Yeah, that's one fix you can do. Oh, sorry. The answer was that one way to fix that is to start count at zero, and that way when you loop through, the max count we'll get is 7, and you're still within the bounds of your array. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay, and so, yes?
What's the if statement?
The if statement, oh, the question was, what is the if statement? The if statement is checking if I plus j is even. So the modulo operator, if... No, because I plus j mod 2, once it returns 0, 0 is the value of that Boolean expression, and if 0, returns false. Okay? So who's next? Okay. Okay. I want to really quickly talk about cryptography. Cryptography is basically a way to turn a string of plain text or any sort of information that you have, modify it somehow using a key, and use that key to get another mangled piece of information. The idea is that you do not allow other people access to that. You do not allow other people access to that information unless they have the key. So in Caesar, if you had the keyword or you had the number K, you were able to interpret the cipher text. And in Vigenère, when you had a keyword, you're able to go backward. The important thing to remember is that not all ciphers have keys, and so not all of them are reversible. And so if you have for example, in Vigenère, if you have an alphabet of 26 letters and you have a keyword of N, and you, N is some number you specify, how many possibilities are there for a keyword? Someone? So I have 26, the answer is 26 to the N, and because you have 20 n elements, each of them can be one of 26 values, and 26 times 26 times 26 times n values is 26 to the n, and that's one way of thinking about how many keywords you have with the Vigenère cipher. So I guess Alex is going to come next and talk about.
All right, hi guys. My name is Alex, and I'll be talking about. Well, I'll start off with recursion. So recursion is like another way. So in the beginning, we started off with iterative functions. So you have a function that just runs through from top to bottom, and it'll just end there. That's called iterative. And recursive is a function that will call on itself. So it'll basically, inside a certain function, let's say int x, somewhere inside, it's going to, you will see the function being called again. And one thing to remember when you're writing a recursive function is that you always need a base case. So the base case is where the program knows where to stop. Because if you continue to call on, let's say, function of x minus 1, you would just keep on decreasing x and never reach an endpoint. And so recursive functions are sometimes very elegant. It's sometimes easier to think recursively than iteratively. So for example, quicksort is a good example to implement something in recursive form. And also, as a practice, sometimes you might need to change a function from iterative to recursive or vice versa. And so, as a way to show you how recursive is better at certain sometimes, let's say if you're trying to write a program that, a function that decreases number from a certain x, you're giving the program an integer x, it goes. And it'll print numbers from x to 1, and then go back up to x. So if you want to do this iteratively, it'll be the thing on the right. So first, you would have a for loop that decreases x from x to 1, and then you have another for loop that prints from 2, in this case, up to x. It looks kind of ugly. And so if you have a recursive, if you implement it recursively, as the one on the left, first you have a base case, so you want to see if x is equal to 1, because that's where you want to start adding the numbers. So that's where you'll set the base case there. If x is equal to 1, then you want to return x should be print f with a number 1. Sorry about a typo. And then otherwise, you want to print the x digit that you're currently on. So you'd be starting off with 5 in this case. And then you want to call the function itself, but with 1 less of the x. So you want to basically start off with, what did I call it? Print. You want to start with print recur of 5, which will call on print recur of 4. And this will continue until you reach print recursive of 1. And this will print 1, and then afterwards, it's going to go back to the function that it was called before, which is print recursive 2. And as you go back there, it's going to run the next line, which says print f, print the digit of 2. So it's going to print first the 5, and then the 4, and then 3, 2, 1. And then you're going to go back that way, printing 2, 3, 4, and 5. Does that make sense to everyone? Anyone has any questions? OK. So with the way I'm drawing, yeah, sure. No, so, okay, so it's, all right, so the first time it's going through, you would have int the variable x equals to 5, correct? And then it's going to check the base case. In this case, x is not equal to 1, so it's going to go to whatever it's running. So it's going to go to else. It says else print f, print the integer x. So in this case, x is 5, right? So these are the numbers for x, and it's going to print this. And then when it calls the next function, the x becomes 4. So that's why it's going to print 4. And yeah?
What if you didn't want to return like the increasing values? What would you put instead of the code?
Do you mean if the code is the way it is on the board?
Yeah, like if you just had it just decrease downwards like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Uh-huh. Okay, so the question is, I think, if you don't have the printf at the very last line, and you just want to print 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and end there. So in that case, you wouldn't have the last print, the second printf. In the first run, when x is equal to 5, when it reaches print recur 5 minus 1, it's going to call on print to recur 4, except at this point you haven't seen the closing bracket for print recur of 5. You're currently executing the last line before you exit the program or the function. Okay. So I don't know if you guys remember the stack frame that we talked about. So the programs get stacked, the functions get stacked and stacked inside this memory location. And the rule is last on, first off. So you would have this stack frame. And then somewhere inside, you would have print recursive of 5. And then that is called, that this function calls on print recursive of 4, right? And this is still there because 5 hasn't ended yet. And this will go all the way until print recursive of 1. And when 1 prints the when that prints the 1, that signals the end of 1. So this goes away. And then print recursive 2, you see the closing bracket for that. So that program gets away, and each one of them gets knocked away, but without doing anything. Does that make sense? OK. All right, so if that's fine, I will move into time complexity. What that means is basically how the performance of something is. And there are 3 different types that we care about. There is the big O of n, which means the worst case. There is the omega of n, which means the best case. And there is the theta of n, which means the expected case. So for example, if you're doing a linear search, and again, linear search is you have a list of numbers and you're searching down from the first one to the last one. And let's say the list of numbers, there are n of them. And so in the worst case, to find that number, the number would be at the very end, or you would never find it. So in this case, the worst case is n. The best case is if n is the first number in the list. So right when you search it, you find it. In that case, the best case would be 1. And the expected case, so you have a list of numbers going from 1 to n. Expected case is sort of like an average, but not really like an average. But it's what you would expect the program to, how you would expect the program to perform. And so in this case, you would intuitively think that n would be, or the theta of n would be n over 2. Except when we're dealing with orders, we only care about the powers of n and not these constants. So you can eliminate this over 2 and just think of the expected case as just n. OK? Yeah?
When would expected worst not be the same?
You mean in this case?
No, in any case.
OK, so the question is, would the best case and the expected case be the same? The answer is no. So I have a couple slides coming up. So this is a linear search that I just talked about. And you're just going down the list to see if you find it. If you don't, go to the next thing. If you do, stop. And if it's not found, return negative 1 to signal that it's not found. In this case, the efficiency is n, or the big O of n, or the worst case is n. The best case is omega of 1, and the expected case is n over 2, or just n. Next slide. Okay, so the binary search is basically you have a list of numbers or whatever you're searching. You're looking for the middle number, and you're cutting the list into 2. And if the number that you're looking for is bigger than that middle number, you know that the number that you're looking for is on the other side, the right side of the list. So you can just omit the first half altogether and just look at the second half. And you can repeat that process continuously until you find it, or until you can't find it. So in this case, made another typo. The worst case would be log n, because you're dividing by the power of 2. The best case would be 1, if the number that you're searching for is in the middle. And the expected case would be log of n. So for the purpose of I guess this quiz that you guys are taking, all we really care the most, I guess, is the worst case. So make sure that you do know the big O of n for all these kind of searches and sorting methods. Can you go to the next slide? Okay, so that's it for the searching method. Do you guys have any questions?
I didn't capture the factorial
slide. You didn't? Oh. It's all right. OK, so if not, we'll go into the sorting methods. So there are 4 sorting methods. Yeah?
I still don't know, when would you ever have a case where the worst and the expected are not the same?
So the question is whether what is the case where the worst or the best and expected case is?
So the worst and the expected case are not the same.
Where the best and expected case are not the same. Oh, sorry. Worst and expected are not the same. I think it's going to come up later. All right. Worst expected. Worst expected. Worst case and expected case. Yeah. I'll think about it and I'll answer that later. Okay. What's that?
In bubble sort.
Yeah. Okay, so what he said is, in a bubble sort, the worst distribution, where you have a list sorted completely backwards, that would be a worse case than just a random list. Yeah.
But I think that also applies to like the examples we've seen before. It's just that like after we take out the concept, it's a concept. Like one half.
Yeah. Right. So she said, in the example that one of the students that just gave, it's possible that after you divide by a constant, after you divide the worst case by a constant, you would still end up with the same thing.
So we'll let you know.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the selection sort, the concept behind it is you're looking through a list, you're looking for the smallest number, and you're swapping that smallest number with the beginning of your current list. So in this case, you're starting off with 2, 5, 3, 9, 1. 1 is the smallest number, so you swap 1 with 2, which 2 is the first thing on the list. And then now the next smallest is 2, so you swap 2 with 5, and you swap, and then you don't swap because 3 is already the smallest. And then you swap 5 and 9, and then you're done with a sorted list. And in this case, the efficiency is n squared because you're going down the list, which is length of n, and you're running that n times. So n times n is n squared. Okay. All right. So quickly, so in searching sort, you're pulling out the smallest number and you put it in the front. And then you're pushing the rest of the list down. Should be very intuitive. If you guys have questions, it's about this. It's in the section notes and also in the review notes. Next slide. Yeah. So the bubble sort is you're going down the list and you're swapping whenever you see a bigger number preceding a smaller number. And the overall idea is the same. So one thing I left out before is when you're calculating the efficiency, if you have let's say a for loop that goes from 1 to n, and another for loop that goes from 1 to n, and one is inside another, the efficiency would be n squared. So the formula for this is efficiency of f of n times g of n will get you the efficiency of the first one times the efficiency of the second one. And if you have two for loops independent from each other, so the first for loop does something, and the second for loop does something else, you're adding the two for loops, and the efficiency would just be taking the bigger order of it. So if let's say the order of the first one is n squared, and the order for the second one is n, the efficiency would just be n squared instead of n squared plus n. I think that's And merge sort, you start with a long list, and you're dividing it into little segments. That you cannot divide anymore, and then you're combining two adjacent small lists, assorted lists, as you go along. So in this case, you start off with 8, and then you cut it down to 2 of 4s, and then 4 of 2s, and then 8 of 1s, and then you start combining them. And this is the most efficient way to sort out of all the ones that we talked about. This one will store it in n log n for all cases. All right? Okay. All right, I will pass the mic over to Aaron.
All right, so I'm covering the last few topics, and the first of which is structs, and then we'll go through pointers, some file, I/O, and I think that's basically the most important. All right, so structures are basically a way for you to define your own data type, and you haven't implemented them yourself necessarily, but you saw them in the last problem set with the whole idea of g.board. So basically, in a struct, like the example that we had with the game Sudoku, is we had, here's G, and you can picture it as a big container, almost like an array, right? And in this container, we have a bunch of different fields. We had, there was board, which was like a 9x9 array of ints. And we had, I think we had x and y, which are both ints. Right. So conceptually, I mean, it's not hard to think about. It's kind of like an array in which there are different size things and different type things, and you can access them by field. So if you want to access this int x, which was the global x for Sudoku, then you would just say, like, g dot x equals whatever you want it to, right? And similarly, you could use g.board, and there are a few different ways to do this. And for example, up here we have this, the struct student, which basically a student with a name, so a string, a year, and an age. All right, so in this case, to use structs, we have a pointer to the struct, and that just enables us basically to define a pointer of our own type, right? And after that, we can call the name by accessing the field directly with a period between the name of the struct and the name of the field. So in the same way that you say like g.x, you could say student.name equals something. Right? And then you can also access it on the bottom, if we'll skip to that one, by dereferencing the pointer, which we'll talk about in a minute, and then accessing the field at that address. Does that notation make sense to everyone? Does it not make sense? Yes. Yeah, so the difference is that in Sudoku, that you physically declared a struct, whereas this one is a pointer. So if instead we had, like, in Sudoku.c, right, so if we had a struct named G, and then we declared a pointer, and we'll call this type, like, of a global type. This is not correct notation, I'm just explaining it. And then we had like a global pointer to just whatever type of struct we defined and called that G. Then similarly, you could access it in the same way. So you haven't seen that notation before, but it's basically just using a pointer to point to the struct in the same way that you would use a pointer to point to an int. And then...
I just have a question.
Yes. 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 Yeah, that's true. Because good point. So when it says the address, so ampersand student one, it assumes that there is some student one that already exists. Thank you. Cool. So pointers, the big conceptual idea rather of structs is just that you can create your own container to store different types of data, kind of like an array. But you can use different types, and you can access it like you would any type with a pointer.
I have a question.
Yes.
Would that be a string, or would that be a parser?
So what is the data type of student 1?
Yeah.
Okay. So we're, right here. That's actually really cool. In this case, because we have a student pointer, then student one has to be that same type. Like in the same way that when you want to point to something with an integer, like you would declare an int pointer. Okay. So it's kind of confusing because we literally made our own data type. Like we declared in the same way that you have ints and chars, and like we have students. And that's what's kind of neat about making a struct.
So student one would be a student.
Right. So where it says student underscore t, that's just the notation for like a student type. So, and there's not going to be a whole lot if, I don't think, like on the exam, because this is something that's very new. But it was something that was on the first two exams last year, so we're just reviewing it. Okay. So then also we'll go into pointers. And I'll erase this. All right. So the basic idea of using a pointer versus using just a value is that in C, when you pass things around, you often pass by value, which means that if you have, here's your main function, right? And then you have another function like swap, for example, right? So if you have the variables x and y in here, and you want to swap x and y, and you pass them over here, that it creates copies of x and y. So we'll call them x1 and y1. So even though they may be called the same thing in some case, they're not actually the same. But with pointers, you can basically store an address and therefore pass that address around rather than passing the value. Okay. So in this example, we declare int inn and then a char star, which is the same thing as a string, s, right? We get input from the user. And can anyone tell me what this point does right here, the loop? So we're iterating over the string, right? While for every element, okay? And then we're printing out the character. And what does this mean right here? I think it's S plus I. Other way around. All right. So in pointers in general, there are two very valuable operators. There's the dereference operator, which is the asterisk, and it says, like, what piece of data lives at this address? So what piece of data is stored at the address of S plus I? Right? Does that make sense? Okay. And also there's the ampersand, just one more here, that basically say if I want to declare a pointer and say, like, an int pointer, I could say int star ptr equals address of I. Okay, assuming I already had the variable I somewhere, like up there. And that basically says I want a pointer to point to I, but therefore I want to store the address, which is what this means, of I in the pointer. So the pointer literally stores the address rather than the value. Is that clear? All right, cool. Yeah, so basically, the S plus I is just an example of pointer arithmetic in the same way that you can access elements of an array by, like, array bracket S plus 1, S plus 2, S plus 3, or 0, 1, 2, 3. You can do the same thing. So S is the address of the start of the array. So if we have an array, right, and here's S. So S plus 0 is still S. So you're accessing this piece right here, right? And then when I equals 1, you basically go to S plus 1. And we know that because S is of type char star, that rather than moving 1 bit or 4 bytes or anything, you know that you move 1 byte. Because it knows the type of the variable and therefore how many places to move. So we move one, like the width of one character over, and this is S plus 1. or s plus 1, and s plus 2, and so on. Right? So that's just an example of pointer arithmetic. Yes?
Could you agree with that as a white contrarian, instead of asterisk s plus times 2, s bracket I?
So I think you can do that with pointers, right? Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. So the question was, instead of using the asterisk s plus I notation, why couldn't we have just written it as s of I? Right? And it's essentially the same thing. It's no different. It's just a different notation. And sometimes, like, this will allow you in the future to do things that this one doesn't. But so they are functionally equivalent. All right. Are there any questions on pointers in general? And I think, like someone said earlier, in the systems that we talk about are always 32 bits, so 4 bytes long. So it's a 4-byte address. Okay.
Does that address have a null thing at the end? Or is it just...
Okay, that's a good point. So so the address itself doesn't, like there's no... Okay, good, thank you. So the question was, does the address have a null character at the end of it, right? So the address itself doesn't, like, an address could be something like, it's just going to be a really long number, sorry. The 0x in the front just means it's in hexadecimal format. So the address is just a number, but if you're talking about the data there, there is always a null character at the end of a char star, so of a string.
But in no other arrays are necessarily a null character.
Okay.
And how long would that address actually be? If it's 32 bits, and that means you can store 4 characters?
Okay, so the address itself, like the size of the address, doesn't tell you the size of the data that you can store there.
Okay.
Like it literally tells you, it just points you to another address.
So I mean the address itself, how long would it be?
The address would be 32 bits or 4 bytes. Yeah. Okay? All right. So we're almost done. And this is also something that's pretty new. Okay. I think this was briefly mentioned on this last week. But pardon me. The whole idea of file input and output. How to open a file, how the computer system treats a file, and how to write data to a file. So I'm just going to briefly talk about what each line in this does, and then that should be all set. So there's a certain data type called file, which as you can see up left it's a constant, which is why it's all in capitals. And when you open a file, you create a pointer to that file. So again, like rather than copying all this data from a file, you literally copy the address, or you can pass it by reference, right? Does that make sense? So rather than passing around or copying each time you want to use this file a new version of it, you can just change the old version. Because otherwise you'd never be able to edit anything. You'd just be creating a new one. So you use fopen, and then it says, I want to open a file called database in the present working directory. And the W means I want to write to it. So there's W, which is write, there's R, which is read, there's read-only, there's read-write. But this is important in this case. And then just like any file, or any pointer rather, that you start using, you want to check if it's null. And if it is null, it means there's an error. But if it's not null, you can start using it. So say we just had some number of students, right? You can use a function called fprintf, which basically says to the file pointed to by file pointer, which is the one that we opened, I want to print out this string, just like you'd print it out to the screen. And in %s, I want to print out the string class i.house. Right? So the class I is a struct, and house is the field in that struct. It's a big jump, but it's very similar. Just like you use fprintf here, it's very similar. Like if you subtract the f and the fp in the beginning, all that is a printf statement. So basically, it's like printing to the screen, but just specifying to a file instead. But the syntax is equivalent. And then just like you want a free memory at the end, you just close the file pointer at the end and say that I'm done writing to this file with fclose. All right. Are there any questions? Okay. And that brings me to the next topic, which is the whole idea of forensics. And this will take, oh, you'll learn a lot about this in the next problem set. But the whole idea of if you delete something, do you really delete it? And how are you going to get back those pictures that David took, right? So you can picture your hard drive, right? So you can just picture it as like a bunch of layers, and there's data stored on this thing called a platter. And all of these things are files, right? And then you have some table that basically all it does is point to each one of these files. Sorry, it's not very clear, right? So say I had a file here and a file here, right? And what happens when I drag this to the wastebasket and I delete it? It actually doesn't erase the memory here. It just deletes it from this list. So essentially all of the data is still stored on the disk, but the computer forgets where it is. Is that clear? So it's just like deleting a pointer. The data is still there, but it doesn't know the address of it. So essentially, if you were to go through and just like try and find these barriers and then basically build a file off of that and just like look at the disk only without looking at this table, that's how you'd go back around, and that's the whole idea of computer forensics. Are there any questions there? All right, let me just check if I missed anything. And other than that, I think you should be all set. No, that was it. So are there any questions? Again, make sure you know which room you're headed to and what your last name starts with. And the quiz is Wednesday at 10, or at 1, rather, 1 o'clock p.m. And if you have any questions, I'll be around, and I think we'll be around to answer them. So thank you.
Also, just to clarify,
yeah, I will repeat it for you. So
for a quick sort.
Okay, so for a quick sort.
And for a binary search tree, which you guys will.
And a binary search tree.
The average and the worst case are different.
Okay, so what he just said, this is Alex who was talking about searching, was that for a quick sort, and a binary search, you said?
Searching the binary tree.
Okay, and searching a binary tree, that the worst and expected cases are different?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was an answer to a question earlier. All right? And other than that, enjoy your day. Thanks.